And good evening, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Other Side of Midnight, the show they don't want you to hear. I mean, last night was a disaster, and I want to apologize to all our listeners, literally all over the world. Our little widget on the website, if you go to theothersideofmidnight.com and look in the upper right-hand corner, you will see the rotating globe, and all the little red dots are people who've logged in, cities, and I mean, we've got oil platforms and folks in the middle of Australia, in the middle of Mongolia. I was sitting here last night doing some work trying to figure out what had gone so radically wrong, and we'll get to that in a minute. And I'm watching the rotating globe, and every time someone connects to the other side of midnight, a little white light pops up, and you got radiating, you know, radiation patterns around it. Very, very artistic, very artistic. So I'm looking in Outer Mongolia. Somewhere in Outer Mongolia, we have a fan. And he was checking, or she was checking, or they were checking all through the night as I'm sitting here, you know, doing stuff, you know, this globe is spinning. And I see, like in India, in Mumbai, someone was listening and checking in. We are a global family. And what this global family needs is a game changer. We need huge changes in the way this planet is being run. And we're going to talk about the mechanism of that game changing tonight with my friend and colleague. And we've known each other a very long time, Tom Vallone, but we'll get to that in a minute. I want to start out tonight by introducing a new member of the Enterprise Other Side of Midnight family. His name is Chris Spell, and he has done something miraculous. He has actually created a podcast for the membership of Club 19.5 for the program. So without further ado, Chris, you're on the air.
Hey, Richard. Good to be here.
So how does this podcast thing work? I mean, I really have not listened to podcasts. And to me, you know, a computer is a computer is a computer. So what makes this different? How do people access it? Who can access it? Who can't access it? What kind of gear do you need? Is it available on a phone? That kind of thing.
Okay. So, yeah, the podcast is a great way to listen to the show on the go or at your convenience. It will automatically download for you. You don't have to visit the website archives and download it. It'll just automatically download to your computer or your smartphone or your tablet, and you can take it with you.
Okay. So how do people get, let's say I'm sitting here doing nothing, ha ha ha, and I've got my phone. What do I do? How do I get into the podcast?
So what you want to do is go to the website, click on the login, Club 19.5, and then you'll see the archives like you're normally used to seeing. And if you look down towards the bottom of the archive page, there's a link to take you straight to the podcast. So you want to click on that, and it will bring up a page that has your personal podcast link on it. So when you get there, you'll see your podcast link. Depends on, you know, which device you're using. There's, you know, everybody has different devices, and there are many, many different apps you can use. And we have some recommended apps on the page. The one that's free for the PC or Mac, it comes with the Mac, is iTunes. And you can load it in iTunes very easily on your computer. You would just click on the iTunes feed, and iTunes will then subscribe you to the podcast. If you are going to use your phone or your tablet, it's a little more complicated there. You need to pick out a podcast app. If you're on Android, we've got some suggestions at the bottom of the page. And you can use any app that you want to use. If you have a favorite podcast app, it'll work just fine. All you need to do is to manually type in your podcast link to your app. One thing that people do that's just not going to work for you is all podcast apps will have a search function in them. And a lot of people will go to the search function and type in The Other Side of Midnight and look for the podcast. And they'll never find it because the podcast is for Club 19.5 members only. So it's a private feed, and it will never show up in any directory. So you'll have to either type in that link manually when you go to add a podcast. On Android, I've noticed that you just click on the iTunes feed, and a little window will pop up and ask you which podcast app you would like to use. So just make sure you install an app on your device first, then click on the link while you're on the device, and it will ask you which app you want to use. Select your podcast app and then subscribe to the feed. And that's all you have to do. If you are on the iPhone or the iPad, I'd highly recommend the RSS Radio app. There's a free version of it in the App Store. You don't have to pay anything for it. And so you would load that app, then click on the RSS radio feed link, and it will load it straight into the app for you. And it will just be very easy.
So what's idiosyncratic about this compared to normal podcasts?
Well, I tell you, I missed it. We used to have a podcast for you a good while ago. And for me, I generally can't stay up to 3 a.m. because I'm on the East Coast. So I fall asleep in the middle of the show and I want to see it or listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I always listen to podcasts when I go to bed or when I get in the car. And so with the podcast feed, it's just automatically downloaded. I don't have to go to the computer. I was going to the computer after the show the next day, downloading it and then uploading it to my personal private podcast feed. So I was still putting it in a podcast. If it's not in a podcast, I'm not going to listen to it. And so this just makes it very convenient to listen to and to download. You just don't have to download it. Now, if you're listening to it on your computer, the archives are probably the easiest thing for you to do. The podcast feed's not going to help you a whole lot. But if you have a smartphone or a tablet and you want to listen to it on the go, or you want it downloaded and not have to even think about it, then the podcast is the way to go.
So how, when people are listening to a podcast, do they access the radio pictures feature of the show?
Well, if you use one of the suggested apps, you will see the link in the show notes section of the podcast. The link is right there. You click on a link and it'll pull it right up on your phone, and you can scroll down to the pictures as you're listening. It makes it so nice, because to be able to do that, and you'll see the graphic, because you guys have a nice graphic for every show. I'm putting that in there. So it worked pretty good. Now, the podcast is not going to be there right after the show, because I'm going to run it through my noise filters, clean out any background noises so it sounds a little bit cleaner. And I'll also am going to be editing out the commercials so we don't have to hear the commercials. And since I'm staying up to 3 a.m., it's going to be the next afternoon before I can get that finished.
Well, but for membership, I mean, come on, membership has its privileges, and
that's
it
right.
Also has, you know, to get all this in line. And I want to emphasize, Chris, you're doing all this because you love the show. You love what we're trying to do. You're not being paid. You're not being slipped, under the table. This is a labor of love, and you're doing it because you think it's important. Why do you think it's important? Why are you volunteering so much time for the show?
Well, I think the show is very important because the subjects you're covering are extremely important to the times that we are in right now. And I don't think there's anything more important, because the word needs to get out as far and wide as we can get it. And so many people can benefit from the podcast that'll just make life so much easier.
Super. How do people, if they have problems, how do they contact you to work their way through this? How do members get hold of Chris Spell, technical wizard who can wade through the podcast universe and straighten out the problems?
Well, on your personal podcast page on the website, you will see at the very top our email address we set up, and you can email us right there. It's at podcastosom@gmail.com. Feel free to email any questions or problems you have. And if you have a favorite podcast app that you like, email me and let me know, and we'll put it up on the webpage, especially for Android. I haven't used Android in a long time, so I don't have a real good favorite app for that. But that'd be great. I also want to say thank you to my wife, Michelle. You've been very patient this week while I worked on the podcast. And all of us listeners owe a really big thank you to Kenthea. She does such a wonderful job in the background and does so much. I had no idea. She's been a really big help this week. So thank you, Kenthea. And I want to thank you, Richard, for allowing me to do the podcast for everybody. I think everybody will be excited as I am to have the podcast. So thank you, Richard.
Super. When we come back, we're going to talk to our main guest tonight, Tom Vallone. And it's one of those shows, Chris, that I think you're doing what you're doing for, because these technologies, if we get them into people's hands, they will literally change the world. And on that note, we'll take a short break. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. When we come back, Tom Vallone. Don't go away. And welcome back to the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and tonight my guest is someone that I wanted to talk to for quite a while about what's going on, because with this new Pentagon disclosure that UFOs, oh my God, UFOs, and by metonymy, ETs are real. And where are we going with that? Well, we're going to have fun tonight talking about where we go with all of this, because one of the reasons that I've heard over many, many decades now for the UFO cover-up, for the fact that the government and government contractors and whatever don't want to really talk about this stuff, is because there is a commensurate technology that comes along with it. A technology, or I should probably say technologies, plural. We're going to get into all the differences in a few minutes, that will totally change life on Earth and for the better. Now, as with everything, there are some downsides, and we'll get into some of the downsides as we talk with Tom. Before I introduce Tom, I do want to do two news notes. One is, if you go to theothersideofmidnight.com and click on the banner, the beautiful banner that Kenthea has again created for Tom's show tonight, all the lightning bolts. That will take you to the guest page, scroll down, and in Radio with Pictures, under my items tonight, two important items. John Young, who was the longest-serving astronaut in NASA, died at the age of 87 a couple days ago. And John was unique. John was an astronaut in three of the four major NASA programs that inaugurated the first age of space. He was the first guy to fly a Gemini spacecraft. He's the one, by the way, that took the corned beef sandwich up against NASA's orders. And when it was lunchtime, he brought it out for his partner, because he was in a twin spacecraft, Gemini twins, you know, which, of course, you know, really kind of didn't sit well with the NASA brass. So they made very strict regulations, no more corned beef sandwiches, et cetera. He also went to the moon twice. He was the command module pilot on Apollo 10. And it was from Apollo 10 that we got some stunning close-ups of the structures on the moon that we're going to talk about in a few weeks. We're going to have an old friend of mine, Ken Johnston, and Steve Troy on. And we're going to talk about Trump's initiative to officially NASA to go back to the moon. Except it may not be NASA. And we'll get into the details of that when we actually do that program. The other thing that John did was he was the first pilot of the space shuttle. He took her up with, I believe, Dick Crippen, when there was no real backup. Remember, in the shuttle, they didn't have ejection seats. So we were committed, and we saw what that meant during the Challenger disaster. Well, John and Dick Crippen took the shuttle up for the first time in, I think, 1981. I was at the Cape. I was working kind of freelancing for CNN at that time. And it was an incredible opportunity to see reusability in space flight. Well, that didn't really work out too well under NASA, because the shuttle never really achieved all the things that we hoped it would achieve. And it would fall to another generation. And a guy named Elon Musk, who successfully tonight conducted, I think, the 20th or 21st launch of a Falcon 9 rocket, and then the recovery back at Cape Canaveral on a big concrete landing pad with a huge SpaceX written across the center. And if you go to the second link under my images for tonight, or my data for tonight, number two, the SpaceX successful launch of the top secret Zuma spacecraft. I have no idea what the Zuma spacecraft is supposed to do. Nobody does. I'm wondering if it's kind of a letter substitution, Zuma, Z-U-M-A. Is there a secret code? What does Zuma stand for? Is it an acronym? Is it some kind of cipher? What's it supposed to do? No one knows, but the government chose SpaceX to launch this super secret satellite. And the cool part is, Elon, again, think now for the 21st time, recovered the first stage, which, of course, is building toward the next revolution in space, which is the second age of space, as I've termed it in some places, which is when we have all kinds of reusability, which means the price for you and me and my guest tonight to get into orbit and see what this planet looks like from the top down it's coming closer and closer and closer. And of course, the next big thing on the SpaceX docket in a couple, 3 weeks, sometime in January, we are told, is the test of Musk's so-called heavy lift launch vehicle, which is three Falcon 9s strapped together. That really doesn't do justice to what they've done. And 27 engines that have to be lighted simultaneously and burn successfully throughout the first stages of the mission for the mission overall to succeed. And of course, the Russians tried multi-stage and multi-engine ignitions with their famous N1. And the damn thing blew up on the pad and incinerated a whole bunch of other structures and infrastructure that the Russians needed if they were going to get to the moon. And of course, that's why they didn't, because the N1 didn't work. Well, Musk is now trying this multi-engine technique for his heavy lift launch vehicle. Instead of creating a few huge engines, he's got, I think, 27 Merlin engines, which is the main engine of the Falcon 9. And we're going to see in a couple, 3 weeks, whether or not he is going to be able to pull this off successfully. So with that out of the way, let me get to my main guest tonight. So this is going to be really fun because we're going to go boldly where very few people have ever gone before. And we're not going to use the words free energy even once. Tom Ballone, PhD, is a physicist and licensed professional engineer with over 30 years of professional experience. He's also a former patent examiner, and boy, is there a soap opera there we're going to get into, a research engineer, an instrumentation designer, a CEO, and currently an author, lecturer, and consultant on the future of energy developments all over the world and beyond. He was the research director for Scott Aviation, Inc., founder of Integrity Research Institute, and the inventor of such electrotherapy devices as the EM Pulsar, we'll find out what that is, the EM Pulse Pad, the Osteopad, and the High Voltage Premier Junior. I really wonder what that one is. Tom has supervised the design and construction of the world's first narrowband 60 hertz Gauss meter without harmonic distortion. Now, that may sound like boring to some folks, but it's really important to other folks. And he also invented the first dental mercury vapor ionizer precipitator. Remember, dental, mercury, dental, you don't want to mix the two. We'll find out what that does. He is the author of Zero Point Energy, The Fuel of the Future, Practical Conversion of Zero Point Energy, The Homopolar Handbook, Electrogravitic Systems, Electrogravitics 2, Bioelectromagnetic Healing, Proceedings of the First to Ninth Conferences on the Future of Energy, and over 100 reports and articles. Tom's also a member of the Institute for Electrical and Electronic Engineers, the National Space Society, and the Union of Concerned Scientists. His works have been published in German, Korean, French, Russian, and yes, English. Tom Ballone, this is your life. No, welcome to the other side of midnight.
Hi, Richard. Good to hear from you, and I'm glad to be on your show.
Oh, I've looked forward so much to this show. It's like, since most people are going to be a little bit, shall we say, unfamiliar with some of the terms and the technologies we're going to talk about, let me start with something very personal. How did you get into the idea, as that, you know, Peggy Lee song goes, this is not all there is. There's a whole bunch of incredible technologies which have been kind of sitting in a drawer, not being used by consumers, not being used by the government, not being used by mainstream science. How did you kind of get onto the idea there was a huge area of science and technology that was not being admitted to?
Well, actually, it's funny because when I was an undergraduate, I constantly would look at the graduate students and think of them as being hypnotized. I was a physics major at the State University of New York at Buffalo, and yet I still was interested in analytical psychology, which is Carl Jung's psychology. So I spent 9 years on the board of directors of the Analytical Psychology Society, Western New York, and got to know all the great Jungian analysts of the world. But to me, it was very interesting because it balanced the physics and psyche type of dualism that the world is really consisting of. Half the world thinks it's materialism. The other half thinks it's, you know, psychological and mind stuff, as they say. Anyways, in graduate school, I found out about End Machine at Bruce De Palma was
there. Ah, yes.
And I learned about that from Norman Paulson's book, Sunburst, Return of the Ancients. So I ended up going out to California, and after a couple of days was allowed to see the machine, got all excited, thinking this is the best thing since sliced bread. And so I went back to the University of Buffalo and asked to do that for a master's degree in physics. And I got a yes.
You did your PhD thesis on the End Machine?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, in 1980.
Now, how did that go over with the faculty?
At a conference every summer, pretty much, since 1980. I went to Germany, actually, for the German Gravity Field Conference to talk about the End Machine, and Bruce De Palma couldn't make it, so I went in his place, and then I started building and testing and wrote the Homopolar Handbook as my first book, describing all the details.
And I've got a copy here.
And that had a UFO background. That had a UFO basis for the End Machine. And from then on, it's always been a balance between my interest in UFOs and my interest in being mainstream, you know, science.
Hmm. For folks that aren't familiar with this technology, let's not leave any stone unturned here. Talk about what the End Machine is and why it's so revolutionary and the difference between what was there at that compound in Santa Barbara and where the technology stands now.
Wow. Well, to be very clear about it, for those listening, the End Machine really is the Faraday disk or the homopolar generator. You might as well get down to what historically it's been called and really rely upon that as the basis for what we're talking about. And the homopolar generator literally is a circular cylindrical magnet, period. Faraday did the first experiment in 1831. He balanced a cylindrical magnet by a string and then twirled it and then saw that there was a voltage between the center and the outer edge. Hmm. And that's pretty amazing because it's the only generator that generates a voltage without commutation. The Earth itself is a good example. The Earth is a spinning homopolar generator. And there's lots of articles been written why the core of the Earth, an iron magnetic core, has all kinds of circulating whirlpools. And the Aurora Borealis is a connection between the pole and the equator, literally. And the voltage across that is causing the Aurora Borealis to a great degree. Hmm. So we have an unusual type of generator, and it seems to have unusual properties. Including if you're on the disk, you can't measure the voltage. I did that experiment. I should publish it someday. But Faraday did it also. He tried to measure voltages in streams and rivers, thinking that the voltage should be measurable, even though you're sitting on the rotating homopolar generator.
Hmm.
So you have to be apart from it. And that's why the space tether experiment continually failed. I have a section in my book describing that repeated failure to measure a voltage across a long conductive wire out in space or low Earth orbit. NASA thought that would be a voltage. Can't be, because you're moving with the generator. So testing for back torque was what I did for the master's degree. And unfortunately, I measured back torque as current is being generated. So the homopolar End Machine, whatever you want to call it, Faraday disk, unipolar generator, even Tesla described, wrote an article about the unipolar generator.
Really?
How to improve it.
Hmm.
Yeah, there's an article. It's in my book. I reprinted the article. Tesla thought it could be a free energy generator. So there you have it. It was Tesla's idea. Blame it on Nikola
Tesla. Oh, my. So where does the technology stand? Because I've never seen a workable End Machine. I knew De Palma very well. We talked about a whole bunch of stuff. You know, his experiments seemed to validate the idea of the hyperdimensional torsion field model time after time. But he was never able, as I understand it, even though he went to New Zealand to try to do it, to develop an End Machine that actually put out more current than you put into rotating the disks.
You're absolutely right. And this field is full of people like that that continually claim to, you know how to do it. And then when you put them to the task, they fail. So unfortunately, it's a really difficult field to make sense out of and also to recommend what direction to go in. I talked to every one of the backers and investors in De Palma's attempts, and each one of them said, oh, I should have talked to you before I put the money into it. So De Palma, unfortunately, it did have a problem. And when I look at it psychologically. There's something here is very contagious, and it's very archetypal. You know, it's literally like the UFO ET gram where somebody's obsessed with something and starts building. And literally there's stories I can tell about inventors who have done that and then more or less successfully obtained something that was workable. But in the De Palma case, it was not. And so I put it aside. I even thought the Russian Searle device was the next answer. In fact, on your website, there's a little 10-minute citizens hearing that I gave some testimonial for at the National Press Club. And there I described the story of how this homopolar generator seemed to be re-emerging in the Searle device, which has a whole bunch of homopolars around the outer edge, all rotating around a ring. And I helped the Russians find an investor and basically thought that this might be the answer that Norman Paulson said he saw when he was on a UFO.
Interesting. So is the problem with the end machine that it's not big enough? Because what I think of it is the Earth, and that was demonstrated by the shuttle mission where the tether was literally fried, and the planet Saturn, all the planets are basically end machines. And when the Voyager mission, which I was, first person witness to at JPL that night, crossed the ring plane back in, I think, 1981, and they programmed a whole bunch of photographs, of various moons, and the scan platform had to move and change and switch and all that. None of that occurred because some radical interference with Voyager occurred as it crossed the ring plane. And I've always thought, based on reading the engineering reports, that what NASA said happened, actually they lied about what happened. It wasn't a mechanical problem in the gears. It was a electronic problem affecting all kinds of systems. And they never admitted publicly that that's really what's going on. And you have to go and dig for these reports to find the details of Voyager encounter with the huge homopolar end machine generator that's represented by Saturn and its rings.
Well, if it was simulated, perhaps computerized and analyzed in that fashion, perhaps there would be some electrical or even electrostatic field that could be identified in the plane of the equator of Saturn.
Yep.
And it's present in other planets, as we know, as well.
Yep.
The question is whether that is detrimental to electronics.
Exactly. Well, if it's unchanneled.
It is a standard one. It's from the equator to the pole.
Yes.
That's where the voltage field lines are extended.
Well,
let's
hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. My guest this morning is Tom Vallone. We're talking about energies. We're starting out with the end machine, but we're going to get to a lot of other interesting breakthrough technologies, which the world doesn't really know about, and they should. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. And welcome back on this Sunday night, January 7th. Do you realize we're almost a week? We're literally a week, I guess, 7 days, Sunday, all that, into the new year, 2018. What is 2018 going to hold? Well, my guest this morning is Tom Vallone, and we're talking about what it could hold, which is technological breakthroughs. Now, Tom, my feeling is that with this official Pentagon disclosure that UFOs are out there and the release of the Navy footage showing, F-18 guys chasing them over the Pacific off the Nimitz, that we're being set up for a process where ultimately the idea of anti-gravity and perpetual energy and breakthrough technologies are going to become kind of the ordinary, you know, rank and file lexicon of conversation. What do you think?
I'm glad you mentioned that all in one breath, because really that's the sum total of why our nonprofit Integrity Research Institute was formed. I took my original idea from 1980 and massaged it over the years. And then finally, when I retired from the government this past year, I feel that now it's time to devote full time to this type of mission, energy, propulsion, and bioenergetics. To begin with that theme that you just mentioned, I wanted to at least share with the listeners, in case they haven't seen it, New York Times has an excellent article on the Navy UFO disclosure that you just mentioned, and I've created a tiny URL for it. It includes a very interesting short clip, a UFO video as well, and it's tinyurl.com/Navy UFO.
Okay, hold it there.
So for anyone that wants to see what we're talking about, tinyurl.com/Navy UFO.
What people need to do now is
really the idea of free energy or perpetual energy or energy with a single capital investment, I think, is man's citizens' rights, human rights, and just as fresh air and clean water are. So once we get to that kind of consciousness, the whole planet can be energized at virtually, hopefully, a very small cost, and that's where the magnetic permanent magnet spiral motor comes in. But there are other devices too that show an excess of energy production.
Hold it there. Let me direct people to where they can go to see this stuff, because you have loaded up the other side of midnight with a whole bunch of very interesting images and videos, and that link you talked about, the Tiny Earl link, is also up there. So what you want to do is go to theothersideofmidnight.com, click on tonight's banner for Tom Ballone. That will take you to his guest page. Scroll down to Tom Ballone's items. Item number one is the Tiny Earl link that he just talked about. And under that is the spiral design permanent magnet motor. And then we have shots of your laboratory, and we've got implications of extraterrestrial technology. So let's kind of go through these in the sequence you want to. What technology do you want to talk about next?
Well, the spiral magnetic motor is, I believe, the easiest, the simplest, and the most promising of the devices that I've come across for generating energy from the magnetic gradient. And with a little creative magnetic switching, I'm going to produce a working magnetic motor within this coming year.
Wow.
And all the ducks are falling in the to have it happen, including this campaign, fundraising campaign, crowdfunding, that's really taken off to at least be able to pay for the rental of the office next to our lab in the office building that we reside in. So that became available just at the end of last year, and I thought, gee, wouldn't it be nice, you know? And once you start dreaming about something, hey, sometimes it starts materializing. So luckily, this campaign has attracted a lot of supporters so far, and I think we're going to have a workable budget to be able to go ahead and put all this, the very models, the simulations that are needed, and the actual prototypes that will attract the investors. To explain what we're talking about, the spiral magnetic motor is designed, first of all, to be an electrical charger generator for electric cars. That, to me, is the first goal, because when you look at electric vehicles today, the only thing that's preventing people from buying electric cars, even though they are, is the distance fear. When will it run out of juice, and can I charge it up on the road? Well, if you have an onboard charger, all of that disappears. And then it becomes such an amazing type of device that we're now seeing newspaper articles, and I quote from the Washington Post here, mechanics see troublesome road ahead. Many are freaking out, quote unquote, over industry's transition to electric vehicles. Well, they're going to freak out even more when they have onboard chargers. Mechanics are going to have real trouble. And within 5 years, we could see a revolution happening on the road.
You know, one of my fantasies is that we get in one of these electric vehicles with this onboard generator, which is basically tapping into hyperspace, the torsion field, and you drive nonstop, except for bathroom breaks, and you might even eliminate those if you bring coffee cans, so nobody could accuse you of secretly, you know, filling up the tank, and you literally drive from Los Angeles or San Francisco to, you know, Lafayette Square in front of the White House. And then you go and knock on the door and say, Mr. President, this is the way you make America great again.
That's right.
So how realistic is that fantasy?
Oh, it's very real. That's exactly what we're doing with the spiral motor. Within 1 year, we will have a working spiral motor that literally generates its own force, which it already is. You'll see the slides on the webpage you just referred to that show the torque that's being produced, the energy, kinetic energy. All we have to do is do a little magnetic switching. And what's, I think, beautiful about it is all the magnetic switching that I had hoped for, which, to be honest, decades ago, the Japanese tried this and they used an electric-powered solenoid to do the magnetic switching. Now, does anybody in the audience believe that electric-powered solenoid is going to solve the problem of a magnetic motor? No. It ended up being energy excessive.
And the primary reason is what?
That it takes more energy to power that darn electric solenoid to do the magnetic switching every cycle than it does for the, than it, and balanced to the power that you get out of the motor. So Kuriteco was a Japanese firm. There was the Sprain motor. There was plenty of people that have attempted this before. But new technologies have come on board due to a lot of interesting inventors and professors like Dr. Uno of the University of Japan, where he has zero power switching using magnetostrictive and piezoelectric device.
So basically, materials advances have improved the Japanese approach, which was big mechanical solenoid systems, and now we're talking something that's more solid state?
Absolutely. With literally zero power, you're only using voltage and no current to do the magnetic switching.
Okay, let's get to
the revolution.
Let us get to basics.
This is the right time we need it.
Well, we sure do need it.
So I'm just taking things off the shelf and putting them together and making this spiral motor happen. Because it's time is, you know, this is a time where it's really needed. When we're looking at 4 to 5 degrees C by the end of 2100, by the beginning of 2100, that's really what I should be saying. Wow. This is a serious problem for the planet. We have to get off of fossil fuel.
Okay.
Really fast.
Let us get back to basics, all right? The end machine was basically a disc where you had brushes that pick off the current and it rotates and it's ultimately you're supposed to have enough current so you could loop it and have a motor from some of the current run the disc and you'd have energy from the vacuum, energy from the field. What makes the spiral design permanent magnetic motor different than the end machine? And please make use of the amazing graphics we've got on the other side of midnight.
Well, the important part would be probably to look at one of the slides.
Okay.
And we can look at slide number 4.
Ah.
And if you click on that image to download, you can download the whole group of them. But the title slide, Spiral Magnetic Gradient Motor Using Axial Magnets, was a conference paper and a journal article, peer-reviewed journal article, that has been published in more than one journal, literally, because the concept has been updated a couple times. And what you can see from the image is literally we're dealing with a spiral assembly, an Archimedean spiral, which means it's a linear magnetic field. And that is the conventional physics that's only used in modern physics textbooks for the Stern-Gerlach experiment. That's the only time the magnetic gradient, a change in magnetic field, this is a changing magnetic field. It's not the stationary one that the homopolar has. Mm-hmm. This is a waterfall. You know, it's a gravity gradient, a thermal gradient, a voltage gradient. All those are used now for generators. Even the osmotic gradient I'm really fascinated by the latest one, salt water next to fresh water, and you can get a generator out of that.
Wow.
And they have one in Norway. Electricity just from the osmotic pressure.
Okay, so again, so
gradient, we can get energy magnetic gradient. They haven't bothered. They haven't solved this problem, and it's so easy to solve.
If we really reduce this to basics, you're saying that in all these other power systems, we use a gradient. When you get close to something, you get more of it. When you get farther away, you get less of it. But we have never used in a commercial system for power generation a gradient of the magnetic field. And that's mechanically right. What this motor, which basically is laid out like a spiral, like the spiral waves in the torsion field itself. So your magnets are laid out in a spiral, and your mechanical parts move at different distances from the magnets, and that gradient separation is what creates what?
The gradient separation creates a force, and what you see in that slide number 4 is a gold large circular magnet in the center, literally suspended in air at the closest point of the approach where the spiral ends. Now, if I do this for a demonstration in my lab, anybody comes by, I'll take my finger and push that brass disc magnet slightly downward, just past the two parallel line shields there. They're permalloy shields. And as soon as I push it down with a finger, it'll start whipping around literally as an anti-gravity device all the way around the circle and stop where it is now, all by itself.
So this
thing has a lot of power going around the circle until it comes to the stopping point. And the sticking point or stopping point or commutation point has always been the conundrum for every scientist and inventor. You can go on Google, look at all the videos on this particular design, including the V-track and double spiral and so forth. They're all having a problem at the sticking point.
Is this a variation on what John Searle has tried to do? And you're obviously going to have to describe what John Searle has tried to do.
Well, if you go back to the other slide, which is the slide number 3, the listeners can click on the implications of extraterrestrial technology, and then they'll actually see what we're talking about halfway through the testimony, which is only a couple minutes long. You'll see an example of the Searle device. Well, the Searle device has a whole bunch of roller magnets around a magnetic ring. Mm-hmm. And that's back where you started with the homopolar generator. Each roller magnet, as it rolls, generates a small voltage. And that's interesting. I thought, hey, this might be very valuable if you make it big enough. John actually has a 3-ring device. He claims to have developed millions of volts. And the anecdotal stories from living legend, John's still alive today, has been very attractive to inventors all over the world. So much so that when I found 2 Russians, the Department of Energy literally called me. I knew a friend there. He says, oh, this looks like something you'd be interested in. Sure was. I love the Searle device, you know. But I didn't know the Russians claimed to have rebuilt it. So once I found that, I thought, oh, let's collaborate and I'll try to find an investor. And I did. And long story short, 10 years later, they still couldn't get it to work. So the homopolar generator is something I really have to put on the shelf. I haven't been able to figure out the Searle device, and I don't recommend that as something to get involved in, especially if you're trying to get a PhD or anything that keeps your job where you're getting funding. So, but the spiral motor, now that's based on solid science. Every part of it has physics background backing, and there's nothing mystical or mysterious about its output.
Okay, so what makes it a breakthrough technology?
The switching process, and that's what the article and basically the online publication demonstrates, and the slideshow demonstrates, the ability to switch a magnetic field quickly is something that even John Wigan solved years ago. If we slide down to where the Wigan wires are described.
Which number is that?
To me, it's, I'll slide down to that particular mention there. The the important part is that the actuators and so forth have been identified as methods for
would
moving
this be number 11
only voltage. Let's see.
Magnetic switching, sure, for SMM.
Yeah. The magnetic switching would be one. The paper goes into more detail. Even Professor Lathwaite's suggestion for increased torque is something that is going to be added to the axial magnet design. But let me just explain what the Wigan wire concept is. Now, this is basically a standard set of two permeability encapsulations in a single wire. And on page 7 of my paper, there's an actual reprint from the Wigan pulse generator that's patented. Well, most people don't know what a Wigan wire is. I didn't know when I first looked into this years ago. But what's interesting to relate to the listeners is that there has been a Wigan wire in every car that's been made perhaps for at least a decade. And this was the substitution for the distributor cap.
Oh.
It literally formed a basis for sparking rather than the standard old 1960s type car where we've had a high voltage, basically Tesla coil providing the spark through a lot of wires that oftentimes got wet and shorted out. So the Wigan wire literally provided a much more dependable automobile. And it's because the Barkhausen domains line up as soon
wait.
Near the wire.
The what domains?
Wigan is the name I'm talking about, W-I-E-G-A-N-D. And let me just throw a number out here. Patent number 3757754.
Okay.
3757754. So anyone listening can at least go to the patent, see what it does, and say, oh, wow, that's unusual. How could something with just two layers of different permeabilities all of a sudden produce a voltage?
Now, when you say permeability,
well, it
again,
does that when a magnet comes near it,
Tom,
and all of a sudden they line up, and if you wind any kind of wire around these Wigan wires, a bundle of them, mm-hmm. All of a sudden you get a high voltage spark. and it resets into a random arrangement immediately afterwards.
You mentioned
so
a word there.
It provides a high voltage spark every time a magnet comes.
We have like about a second delay, so I want you to define a term because you use the term permeability, and of course that's going to go over most everybody's head. What the heck is permeability, and how does it work in this technology?
The idea of permeability is how permeable a metal is to a magnetic field.
Okay.
For example, the soft steel is considered a metal of high permeability because it will magnetize easily. Most refrigerator magnets have some type of ceramic that has high permeability, but soft iron is usually the best example. Considered high perm. There's mu metal, there's permalloy, there's lots of other exotics. But the physics term called permeability refers specifically to something that's magnetizable.
Okay, if we go back to image number 4, I see this little disc, which you say is the magnet, and it's suspended in free space. Those little white or those bright colored, that spiral, each of those separate little dots, those are magnets, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, spiral number 6 is the same thing. You have another slide number 6. We'll stay with number 4. Yep.
Well, that does, number 6 is a perspective view. I just want to know how do you wind up getting mechanical work out of this, and how does it keep going forever? It's all the secret is in the switching?
Right. Exactly. Okay. And to be honest,
then walk us through step
by step.
Please, Tom. You got to listen carefully because we have this huge delay and we're dealing with a lot of technical stuff that people who are not technical are going to get lost in. So let's walk very simply. Right. How does it work and how does the switching make it work like a breakthrough / ether connected engine, which will never run out of fuel?
Well, probably the best way to demonstrate that would be to click on slide number one, and you can actually see my hand moving the stator magnet slightly, very slightly, with the V-track double spiral radial design. And that's the culmination of all the axial ones we just looked at.
Okay.
The radial design is a little bit easier to work with, and also it deals with most of the magnets being on the rotor. So we have a more understandable...
I'm watching this video. You put your little finger on that brass magnet, and you moved it, and then it whipped around, but it stopped. And that's the problem. It stopped. How do you keep it going?
Well, there you go. Now keep going through that video that everyone can click on, video number one we're talking about. And then as you proceed through the video, you'll see at the end of the two-minute video, I'm actually demonstrating the movement, the continual movement of the V-track rotor. And all I'm doing is moving that stator magnet slightly to vary it just at the switching point so that it diminishes the coupling at the closest point.
When you say coupling, you mean the sticking of the magnet to the other magnets?
Exactly. We're overcoming the sticking in any number of very easy methods that have been available only in the past 10 years. All the methods I'm using now have been recently available. And luckily, I finally retired from the government so I can devote full time to this. And with this crowdfunding support, it's been, I would ask our listeners, whatever you can contribute, this is really for the good of mankind. We have a nonprofit charitable organization, and I collect no salary from the Institute. So I'm just volunteering my time, really, for seeing this breakthrough happen and hoping it will literally get out there in the fastest method possible.
Do we have a link on the site tonight for your crowdfunding for this technology?
Yes, we do, and that's right at number one. Slide number one is the tiny URL that gets you to the Indiegogo crowdfunding site.
Okay. I see it. And you've raised $3,800 so far.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's been only in the past.
Yeah. We have used this show as a vehicle to raise funds for other interesting technologies like the M drive. We'll talk about that later. But we raised, like several thousand, maybe 4,000 or 5,000. And Dave Disler created an M drive based on our funding. In his garage, which now actually is now past peer review. The thing works. The papers have been peer reviewed. And we're talking to him about developing a much more efficient M drive so we can go and chase this object, which came through the solar system about 2 months ago, Oumuamua. You've heard about Oumuamua, I presume.
Yes, it's very unusual. I'm surprised you call it an object. Everyone else called it an asteroid. But it is an oblong shape, so it's a little bit weird.
Well, no. It's much more interesting than that. It's unquestioned, Tom. It's artificial. We can prove that. I don't want to take the time on your show to prove it, but I will send you the data. There's no doubt in my mind. There's no doubt in my mind that this object is artificial. It's a probe sent to us to kind of ping us to see where are we in the 21st century. And there's a whole bunch of people mainstream who are now talking about it as an interstellar probe as opposed to an asteroid. Remember, we're not seeing it as an object. We're seeing it as a point of light. And all the inferences are based on brightness variations and spectral, colors of this little point of light. But the reason that we know that it's artificial is the celestial mechanics, the orbital determinations, the actual numbers assigned to its hyperbolic orbit and its rotation and period and all that, they're all specific artificial numbers that go back to the whole torsion field science and technology. So somebody sent us an incredible gift, and it's up to us to decode it, go out and catch it, land on it, go inside and find out what our Christmas present was supposed to be, because it came through the solar system at the end of 2017, and we can still reach it if we can get the M drive privately funded through, crowdfunding or whatever, and kind of duplicate the same process you're doing with this spiral motor. So let me go back to the motor. The key is you want that. Go ahead.
I wanted to call attention to the fact that we're missing a slide.
Oh.
And the slide number 4 has an active link right in the image.
Okay.
And so if the easy solution would be, as I just did now, to right-click, save target in a new, save a link, open the link in a new window, then you can see the complete slideshow.
Okay.
And at that point...
Have you refreshed your screen?
The reason I say that is right on the slide number 4, if we right-click and open link in new window, you'll get the complete slideshow in PDF. And then you can scroll through all the slides and get to slide number 13.
Okay. So the...
And the reason I'm at is there is your Wagon Wires in great detail.
Ah. Can we put that up so it's not a double or triple click? It's just a one click? And you can write me in the Skype window and I'll read that. And then if we can do that, I'll announce when it's up and posted. Tom, So your demo there, when we click on number 1 and we see the little video, it looks like it works, except there's no switching in your demo. That's in that other device up on your desk further from you. And in the video shows it actually whipping around, right, continuously with the switching? Did I lose you?
Yeah, I lost you for a minute.
Okay.
Back in there, too.
Did you hear the question?
We got other interference things happening. We'll try to deal with it. But you're right. What you're saying is true about the video, and the switching is what we're asking funding for. Because now that I published this years ago, and I thought, lots of people will pick up on it, and this thing will be solved and built and on the market. Well, years went by, and nobody built the thing. Nobody solved this. This is 2014 when the latest version of the paper got published. 2010, 7 years ago, was when I first published it in the Space Power Energy Conference proceedings with the Institute of Physics, National Institute of Physics backing. So this was distributed worldwide, and nobody in the world took my suggestions and built it. So I figured, hey, now it's time for me to put it to use and prove it can be done, and all the secrets are in the paper and in slideshows.
Hmm. So when you get this built, you know, let's think of the finished product. It's sitting on your desk. You start it by what? By flipping a switch or nudging it with your finger, that kind of thing?
I'll literally probably be releasing a clamp that will hold it from going continually. Because I don't want to wear out the bearings for no good reason.
And you know what I've done?
But, hey, this is going to be generating electricity.
You know what I've done?
That's the main hope dream of this.
I've gotten lost in your presentation, and I actually blew past the break at the top of the hour. So let's do that. My guest this morning is Tom Ballone. We're talking about breakthrough energy technologies. And we're trying to keep up with the rate at which the world is changing. It definitely needs additional non-polluting technologies, which are essentially limitless if you tap into the torsion field or the ether or whatever other name you want to use to describe this. We'll get back to Tom and the spiral motor and some of the other technologies we're going to talk about when we return. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. Don't go anywhere. Thanks for listening to this exciting first hour. Now, the second and third hour of the show is available to Club 19.5 members only. Please support the show by subscribing to Club 19.5 and join our very interesting community. To do that, please visit the website, theothersideofmidnight.com, and click on the Join Club 19.5 link in the left-hand column. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll gain access to the rest of this show and all previous 350-plus shows that we have done. Now, recent Club 19.5 member archive recording have the commercials removed, and the sound quality has been enhanced. You'll also receive a dedicated private podcast feed that contains these enhanced show recordings. And you'll be able to download the MP3 files directly from the archive if you prefer. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll have access to a private chat server that member used to chat about the show during the show, and you will have a direct channel to post a question that will be read on the air to the guest. And you'll have a place to post questions during our open hailing frequencies. We realize that not everyone wants to call in live, and this gives you an easy way to participate in a live show without having to participate. Club 19.5 members can use this private chat to talk about the shows, ask questions, suggest new guests, and I may even pop on from time to time to answer specific questions. Also, the entire Bridge crew is in these participating chat channels, so you can interact with them as well. You'll also be the first to preview our new videos and reports. We'll be adding exclusive new features to Club 19.5 as we go forward, and boy, have we got some amazing things to tell you about in the coming weeks. So please support the show and don't miss all the exciting new things we have planned. I want to thank all our Club 19.5 members because without your guys' support, this show would not be on the air. Please help us continue growing the show by subscribing to Club 19.5 today. And when I say we really need you, we really need you. Over and out. Thank you.